volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Today on Wings, we remember feminist historian and performer Sally Roche Wagner, who died June 11, 2025, just shy of her 83rd birthday. One of her great accomplishments was rediscovering the saga of canceled U.S. women's suffrage leader Matilda Joslyn Gage.
I do historical performance. I perform as Matilda Joslyn Gage, and I perform as Elizabeth Cady Stanton. I will never perform as Susan B. Anthony, because I don't respect her sufficiently to call forth her spirit.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Sally Roche Wagner was one of the first scholars to study and teach women's studies in the U.S. She is also known for performances in which she impersonates founding 19th century feminists. On the 150th anniversary of the meeting that launched the women's rights movement in Seneca Falls, New York, Wagner talked to Wings reporter Elaine Clift. Among her remarks was a surprising revelation about our most famous founding suffragist, Susan B. Anthony, whose face is memorialized on the U.S. dollar coin.
When I read Matilda Joslyn Gage calling Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton traitors to the movement, had I been a trained academic historian, I would have said, I know that's not true. This is some crackpot who's just a malcontent. We can just discard her and go on with the real story and the real history. But having been trained in the feminist movement, especially in those early days when there were axioms that we lived with, one of them was the personal is political. Another one is if a woman says something, it's to be believed. And what we know now is that sometimes if women have been victimized so terribly, they may have the place wrong and the details wrong, but the ultimate truth of what they're speaking may be far deeper and more painful and troubled. Out of that training, I knew that there was truth there, and I knew that it would take me years and years of study to find the truth of what Matilda Joslyn Gage was saying, but I felt her integrity strong enough that I wanted to find out what it was she was talking about. That was in 1973. It's now 1998. I have a fairly good fix on the answer to what she was meaning.
There are a lot of people who won't know who Gage was. Can you talk about her in the context of the women's movement? Because most people do know something about Stanton and
Anthony.
They were called the trio or the triumvirate. The three names linked together in the history of women's suffrage will live on in the hearts of posterity, was one of the statements made about them. They shared leadership positions in the National Women's Suffrage Association, president, vice president, chair of the executive committee. They were the three minds behind the movement. Stanton was the writer, Anthony was the activist and organizer, and Gage was in fact both. For example, when they presented the Declaration of Rights of Women in 1876, Gage and Stanton penned that declaration, and Gage and Anthony presented it illegally. Gage was on both parts of that. The reason that we don't know about Matilda Joslyn Gage is one of the most important stories about the women's rights movement, I think. In 1889, Susan B. Anthony engineered a merger between the more conservative American Woman Suffrage Association and the more radical National Woman Suffrage Association. It, in fact, brought in the Woman's Christian Temperance Union, conservative Christian women who wanted to get the right to vote in order to put God in the Constitution, setting up a political test, a religious test in the country for the first time. If you would not swear allegiance to Christ as the head of the government, you could not hold political office in the United States of America. That was their vision. Matilda Joslyn Gage said, "This is the greatest danger of the hour, this attempt to merge church and state." She tried to undo this merger because she saw it as the death of the progressive woman's movement, and she saw it moving in a very conservative, very dangerous to her direction. She was unable to undo that merger. She went on to form her own organization, an anti-church organization. Stanton initially said she'd be part of it. She said she was sick of the song of suffrage and that it was time to be about the real enemy of women, going after the church, which had set up the theoretical foundation that woman must be subordinate to man, that woman is inherently evil, and that woman must obey. And those three teachings, both Gage and Stanton believed, were really at the foundation of woman's oppression, and that woman wouldn't be free until she got rid of those ideas. But Stanton then accepted the presidency of this new merged organization, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, and didn't go with Gage's group. Gage was really on her own at that point. She lost ties with the organized women's movement. She broke ties. But she also lost her friendships. She lost the people that she'd worked with for all these years. And she was absolutely right. The movement became more and more conservative, began making the argument, give women the right to vote, because white native-born women outnumber African-Americans, outnumber immigrants, and woman suffrage is a way to maintain white native-born supremacy. They began arguing racist and xenophobic arguments for giving women the right to vote. And Gage was not part of that movement. She continued to fight the church. In 1893, she wrote her major work, which talks about the sexual abuse of children and women by priests, by the clergy. It talks about the traffic in women. It talks about women getting unequal wages. It talks about women not being allowed into the clergy, not being allowed to define God. She talks about it was with the removal of the feminine, the removal of the female in the Godhead, the creation of an entirely male God, that the position of women became lower than it had ever been in the history of the world. As this movement became more and more conservative, Gage was more and more of an embarrassment with her beliefs that every religion that has existed upon the face of the earth has oppressed people, that the true religion is that which sets people free. She says, "I will have nothing to do with this parody of religion that is the Christian church." She kept a vision of what true religion would be about, and she saw the manifestation of it in the church of her day as being the opposite of what true religion was. That in fact it had been they called it the bulwark of slavery, because there was not a single church that spoke against slavery. They called it the bulwark of woman's oppression, because the churches were upholding the idea of woman as being inferior, subordinate, that argument of St. Paul. So as she became more an embarrassment, the organized women's movement just simply wrote her out, and wrote out that whole part of the history of the women's rights movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton went on to write the Woman's Bible. Although she initially accepted the presidency of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, she remained a gadfly. And as it became more conservative, she troubled it more and more, letting them know how she felt about it. And finally, when she edited the Woman's Bible in 1895, the conservative movement dissociated themselves from her. One of my favorite Stanton stories is that on her 80th birthday, 1895, she was given the grandest birthday party one could ever imagine, the largest hall in New York City, and thousands of people came to pay tribute to her. This was the moment when the politic thing to do would have been to just gracefully and gratefully accept being honored. Instead, she got up and said, "Well, we're going to get the vote soon. That's a non-issue. What we really need to be about now is rewriting the Bible. The Bible isn't the Word of God. It was written by man out of his love of domination. And just as we've rewritten every other work of man when it has no longer met our needs, the Constitution, for example, we amend periodically, it's now time to take our pen to the Bible. And we need to remove the offending passages that have worked for the oppression of people." I love that she had the courage to do that and the grace. And I think she got written out to some extent the same way that Gage got totally written out. Now, the story of Matilda Jocelyn Gage and the writing out of her from history is the writing out of other important pieces of information, major pieces of information about our movement, the women's rights movement.
One piece of information Sally Rush Wagner gained from studying Matilda Jocelyn Gage was how early feminists were influenced by their First Nations neighbors in the Great Lakes region, people known as the Haudenosaunee, or the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy.
Where did Matilda Jocelyn Gage, this foremost theoretician of the women's movement, the 19th century women's movement, where did she get her vision of what a transformed world would look like? It was so thorough, so complete. She said, every existing form of the institutions, church, family, capitalist, and state, rest on the oppression of women. And women will not be free until every existing form of those institutions is destroyed. How does a woman living at a time when she's not even able to attend college because every college and university is closed to women, where does this woman get such a vision? I knew from my experience in the women's movement that you didn't see from A to C without going through B. That when we began the movement, we narrowly could envision what rights would feel like, but we couldn't envision what it would look like to live in a world in which rights were no longer an issue, in which gender balance had been achieved for such a period of time, for generations, that people lived in the presence of it as a reality. Rights were as far as we could go. How did she get to balance without going through rights was my question. She says in her major work, Women, Church, and State, in talking about the Iroquois, the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, never was justice more perfect, never was civilization higher. And I knew that was a clue, but it wasn't until I got a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship and had 9 months to just study and contemplate that I had a chance to really look for an answer to the question that had troubled me. And what I did was to just simply inhale everything I could about the Iroquois. And I was in a, you know, working my study in Carmichael, California, not knowing if there were any of the Six Nations still existing, not knowing whether she knew what she was talking about. I started out with her sources, which she cites, and then went to who were her friends, who were the people she trusted, what did they read, what would they have seen, what did they write, what did they talk about. And what began as, if I'm to be truthful, a real arrogant attitude of, oh, come on. What could Indian women have taught white women anyway? They were nothing but beasts of burden. And not recognizing that my own white supremacy, my own racism was so strong that it was not getting in the way of my scholarship, it was totally blocking it. It was not allowing me to even see the answer that was right in front of me. A humbling experience, to say the least. The result of that has been that I move very, very cautiously, very slowly. I figure that I'm most likely to get it wrong. That as a white scholar trying to understand another culture, the most likely scenario is that I'll do violence. So I didn't write anything, I think, for 8 years. I only wrote when traditional Iroquois people, Haudenosaunee people, asked me if I would write something. And at first all my publication was just in Native American publications. I thought if I get it right with them, which most of the time white people tell the story very, very wrong, then if I move slowly enough and get feedback enough, people will set me straight enough, then maybe I can tell a piece of the story. I can't speak to the experience of Haudenosaunee people. I can speak to what I see, and I can speak to research that I feel pretty proud of. I've looked at about 300 years of sources. I have thousands and thousands of pages of notes on the computer. I write only from a tiny fraction of what I have researched, but I want it to be as solid and as clear and as accurate as I can make it. What I think happened with the influence of the Iroquois is that the women whose eyes, ears, hearts were most open to hearing the possibility of another way of being saw women who lived with rights that you and I can hardly dream of today. They saw women who were responsible for choosing the representatives from the clan. The Grand Council is made up of representatives from each of the clan. So the authority for that representation rests with the women. The women nominate the chiefs. The women sit with the chiefs in council, inform the chiefs, and the clan mothers have the responsibility of removing the chief if he doesn't do what he should be doing. So they have, in some ways, a balance, but the women have an authority that's quite remarkable. The lineage is still, and it was in Gage and Stanton's time, lineage through the mothers. You are your clan because your mother is that clan. So if a mother died, or if the mother and father separated, the child always stays with the mother's clan. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Jocelyn Gage lived in a time in which women had absolutely no rights to their own children. In fact, husbands could will away unborn child on a deathbed, and the child would be given to the rightful owner once the mother had birthed and finished nursing it. And the mother had no legal recourse. But they knew women who had absolute sovereignty of their own bodies. And interestingly, Stanton talks about the sovereignty of your own body. Not women should have rights to control their own bodies. Women should be absolute sovereigns of their own bodies. That's a very different concept. And it's a concept that really makes sense in Native American political terms, in terms of sovereign nations, that sort of being absolute authority of your own being. They knew women who, well, and here we get the connections. Matilda Jocelyn Gage was arrested for voting in her own village in Fayetteville, New York, having worked for 40 years to get women the right to vote. She was arrested for attempting to vote in a school board election. The same year, she was adopted into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation and given a say in the choosing of the chief. Did this connection make an impact on her? It's hard to imagine that it didn't. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was called a heretic because she said that women should be able to leave loveless and dangerous marriages. And the church's position was that marriage was a covenant with God. It was not an institution created by human beings, so therefore it could never be severed, even if the woman's life was at stake. And she talks about divorce Indian style, which is that the woman just puts the man's belongings outside of the longhouse, she says. You know, if he behaves inappropriately, he's gone. And she speaks with some amazement at that. She was called a savage for having birthed a 10-pound daughter and getting up immediately afterwards and being out the next day. And she said, strange, isn't it, that only Christian women suffer in childbirth, and then goes on to describe the birthing process for Native American women. It goes on and on and on like this. The first women to wear a reform costume rather than corseting their waist to 18 inches, dying in childbirth because they had displaced all their vital organs. Dress reform was really a matter of life and death. Dress reform in the 19th century to get rid of corsets was like health reform in the 20th century, getting rid of anorexia, women dying for fashion then and now in different ways, but it's the same issue. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was a great health and dress reformer, very strongly committed to it, and talks about the vitality and the strength of Indian women. And she also talks about the need to dress differently. Her cousin was one of the first to wear a reform costume, which was women wearing tunics, you know, sort of slightly fitted dresses, short dresses, and then leggings. The very first costume was not trousers, it was leggings. Leggings as leggings are worn by Iroquois women. Now, where did white women get the idea to wear leggings? Where did they get the idea that women might have healthier bodies if they dressed differently? Perhaps it was partly at least through seeing women who in fact had healthier bodies because they did dress comfortably and adopting a dress very similar to theirs. So in terms of voting, in terms of birthing, in terms of health, in terms of a number of issues, I think that these suffragists, these women's rights advocates, were influenced by their closest neighbors, the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy. They did have direct contact. Lucretia Mott came to Seneca Falls to plan that first women's rights convention from Cattaraugus, the Seneca Nation. She had been there with the Friends meeting that she was part of, a place there where they were educating the Seneca, and she spent time there. She watched the strawberry ceremony. She watched women take part in the political decisions that were going on, and that's the energy with which she came to Seneca Falls or Waterloo when they planned that first convention. Elizabeth Cady Stanton had a cousin named for an Indian chief. Peter Skenandoah Smith was named for a close friend of the family, Chief Skenandoah of the Oneida Nation. Matilda Jocelyn Gage was adopted, as I said, into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation, wrote extensively about the Iroquois and the superior position of women among the Iroquois, and she was, in fact, working on a book on the Iroquois at the time of her death. Unfortunately, that manuscript doesn't survive.
Although the works of Matilda Jocelyn Gage would be largely unread after her death, her vision of an ideal world would become quite popular through an odd twist of fate.
Matilda Jocelyn Gage's youngest daughter, Maud, clearly her favorite. She was a good mother, loved all her children, but little Maudie was everyone's favorite, the unexpected child that comes 10 years after the other children have all begun to grow. And Maud went to college, as her mother had been unable to do. In fact, Maud went to Cornell, as her brother Thomas Clarkson had done, because Matilda Jocelyn Gage helped open the doors of Cornell University to women. Maud comes home. Well, Maud plans to graduate from Cornell and then go on to law school. She comes home from college Christmas of her sophomore year and tells her mother that she's dropping out of school to marry an itinerant actor. Her mother says, "No daughter of mine shall marry an itinerant actor." And Maud says, "Then we shall elope, mother." Gage looks at her. Matilda Jocelyn Gage looks at this child who is as willful as she is, who is really the mirror of her, and just collapses with laughter. And they both end up laughing and realizing their wills are perfectly matched. And Gage says, "Well, of course, I'll give you your wedding." And Maud says, "Oh, I know you would." And but Matilda is really very concerned because this son-in-law, while she loves him dearly, he's just a sweetheart, can't keep a job. I mean, he's an actor because his father indulges him. Rich father indulges him anything he wants. He wants to be an actor, so his father buys him a theater, essentially. And he goes from one thing to another, and he just you know, bankruptcy is not something that's unknown to him. She finally says to him, you know, you should write down those stories that you tell the boys that they love so much. Because the children would just come from, when he was coming back, he was actually a traveling salesman selling china on the road. He'd come home and the neighbor kids would gather and his own boys would be asking for stories. Well, this is a story of listen to your mother-in-law. Because the year after Matilda Jocelyn Gage died, her son-in-law did follow her advice, and L. Frank Baum published The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which has, of course, if you read all 14 of the Oz books, it is the matriarchy that Matilda Jocelyn Gage writes about as the prehistoric golden age of women when female energy, female will, female vision reigns supreme. The spiritual leader of Oz is Glinda. The political leader of Oz is Ozma. And Dorothy is sort of the temporal every woman, the common sense girl who gets herself out of every jam and everybody else as well. She is the, I think, prairie girl. His nieces, he had no daughters, L. Frank Baum and Maud had no daughters, loved their nieces. And their nieces all lived in North Dakota or South Dakota on the prairies. They were just strong-willed prairie girls. I did hours of taping with Matilda Jewel Gage, who was the granddaughter, the namesake, and the only living grandchild at the time of Matilda Jocelyn Gage. She remembered her grandmother, went to her funeral when she was 12. And the voice of Matilda Jewel Gage in those tapes is very much the voice of Up and Adam Dorothy. I think that he really took the voice of his nieces as the voice of Dorothy.
And I think it's terribly important to point out the suppression of that work, so talk about that a bit.
It's very hard to find a library today that has an original set of Oz books. Partly it's that people have found the value of them. You know, a first edition of The Wizard of Oz now could put your kids through college almost, but, well, maybe not quite that, But the other reason is that in the 1950s, the books were censored. During the McCarthy era, they were censored because in Oz, everyone gets what they need, and everyone gives what they can. There are no rich, there are no poor in Oz. There are no churches in Oz. And his idea of a utopia was Joseph McCarthy's idea of communism, the terrible enemy. And so during the 50s, in fact, the books were removed from the shelves, and many libraries today have only now restocked their shelves with newer editions of the Oz books.
Sally Rush Wagner talked with Elaine Clift during the 150th anniversary celebration of the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention, a gathering whose aims have not all been achieved even today.
The uncanny similarities between the rise of the religious right in the 1890s and the rise of the religious right 100 years later say to me that to honor the memory of Matilda Jocelyn Gage and to continue her work is to continue to fight against the conservative teachings of the church in regard to women. When the Baptists just recently came out with a reaffirmation of the very ideas that Gage was fighting 100 years ago, saying, this is the foundation of woman's oppression, I hear her voice saying, the work is not yet done.
Sally Rush Wagner died June 11, 2025. One of her legacies was preserving the home of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, now a museum and center for social justice dialogue in Fayetteville, New York. Wings thanks Elaine Clift for that interview. Thanks also to your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.